Quran from the activists. Quds explained how the incident left her with minor injuries, but no regrets.
Here the police dragged me, and the man was shouting that I stole his property. I think he was scared because he knew hitting me was wrong, so he had to justify it by saying I stole. As soon as the police heard the word stealing, they immediately put me in handcuffs and gave him back the Quran. The police asked me what happened. I said I saw our Quran being burned, and I just wanted to put it out. And then I saw another Quran with shoes on it, and I wanted to take the shoe off. But I didn't realize that the shoe was nailed on the Quran. I told the police they hit me and strangled me, but they replied with, it's their freedom of speech. So I replied, okay, so it's also my freedom of speech to protect the Quran. I thought the police came to help me, but they turned out to twist the story by saying I was trying to steal.
Quds now faces a day in court, while her injuries have left her struggling to walk. Meanwhile, Muslims across the world remain in a state of anger as calls for serious action and retaliation to Europe's defense of far-right hate speech continues.
Despite Copenhagen officially condemning the incident which occurred just where we stand outside Iraq's embassy a few days ago, that doesn't mean that they've outlawed the practice. And according to reports, several other similar incidents have already occurred since, with far-right activists again targeting the diplomatic buildings of Muslim-majority nations here in the Danish capital. However, this has come at a price. Denmark's defence of the so-called free speech of far-right activists to attack Islam's holy sanctities has led to both Denmark and Sweden's reputation to plummet across the Muslim world. Questions should surely be asked now whether it is indeed within the diplomatic interests of European countries to defend such a fringe extremist practice when, of course, there is so much at stake with economic backlashes from the Muslim world. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian welcomed his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Mehdad in Tehran on Monday. The visit is aimed at boosting bilateral ties at various regional and international levels. It follows a historic trip by the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to the Arab state back in May.
One of our common priorities is to follow up on the agreements between the presidents of the two countries during the recent visit of Dr. Raisi to Damascus. In the past weeks, with the efforts of the ambassadors of the two countries, we have seen progress in the implementation of economic, commercial, and technological agreements between the two countries.
The two diplomats also explored avenues for advancing commercial and economic collaboration. Both Tehran and Damascus are actively pursuing de-dollarization in their trade transactions, aiming to reduce reliance on the greenback.
We've agreed that business transactions between Iran and Syria will be done with the national currency of the two countries.
Countering destabilizing elements in the region, notably the Zionist regime, was another line of discussion. The Syrian foreign minister emphasized the destructive impact of the Israeli regime, reflecting the side's joint commitment to addressing such challenges.
What we are witnessing today in the Zionist entity and regime, the depth of the crisis, that it is an illegitimate regime. Its main objective is occupation and the building of settlements at the expense of lands of others. The indigenous people of this land, the land of Palestine, or the people of Palestine.
During their bilateral dialogue, the focus also centered on the contentious issue of the illegal U.S. military presence in Syria, widely perceived as a primary catalyst for regional terrorism.
Iran and Syria are two long-time allies whose joint record in the fight against terrorism in the region has been significant at the global level. The relations between the two countries can be improved to an important level by removing economic and commercial obstacles. Farzan Ashuryun, Tehran.
The EU's own agencies say 96.5 million people in the bloc are at risk of poverty. Those struggling to pay their mortgages have been given more bad news. The European Central Bank has raised interest rates for the 9th consecutive time, and a 10th increase in September is not being ruled out.
The options are on the table, to continue to hike or to hold. And we also know that it will vary meeting by meeting because we want to be determined by the data.
Fuel and electricity providers are making record profits in the EU. That's good for government tax collection, but it doesn't tell the full story. For example, on paper, the Republic of Ireland has one of the best performing economies in the Eurozone. Latest official data shows in that country a record 12,500 people, including thousands of children, are homeless. Sanctions against Russia and financial support for Ukraine are factors that continue to place enormous strain on the EU's economy. Many citizens point the finger at Washington.
What the United States decides, Europe has to follow, unfortunately. And I don't think it's the best solution to keep sending weapons.
War costs a lot. I think many, many industries are earning a lot of money thanks to the war.
We've raised these issues with the EU's executive arm, the European Commission.
We can send billions of euro to Ukraine, but is there a coordinated response in terms of the social justice problems and the cost of living crisis in the EU?
At least 15 million people, including at least 5 million children, should be lifted out of poverty by 2030. And all member states have presented their national targets to contribute to this joint ambition.
But critics of EU foreign policy suggest citizens will continue to pay a big price for many years to come. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ashura, the 10th day of the month of Muharram on the Islamic calendar, is a day where millions of Shia Muslims worldwide commemorate the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Imam Hussein, who was martyred by forces loyal to the tyrant of the time some 14 centuries ago. Traditionally, the legacy of tragic event has been mourned inside the Muslim world, but is now spreading to new regions, including in areas where hostility towards Islam remains high. Thousands of Shia Muslims live in Turkey to raise awareness among new Western audiences of Imam Hussein. Prior to the arrival of Shia Muslims, very few Danes would have even have heard of Imam Hussein's great sacrifice at Karbala all those centuries. But now the community faces a new challenge, not only to educate the locals about Islam, but how to effectively combat the shocking rise of aggressive anti-Islam activism from far-right activists. In this year's march, demonstrators held copies of the Quran as a peaceful response to the recent desecrations of the holy book by the far right, witnessed in Denmark and other Scandinavian countries. The desecration of religious sanctities is a vile practice which local authorities refuse to ban despite the great distress caused across the Islamic world.
When we talk to journalists from Danish TVs, they don't understand why we react, some of us, on a different way than just ignoring the burning. What we are afraid of is that it can start with burning the Holy Quran, it can continue with other holy scripture, but that is not what we are afraid of. We are afraid of that it would end as it did with Jews in Germany. Today we have had up to 12,000 participants, and they are growing every year, mashallah. This is one of the good things of promoting Imam Hussein, and especially his principles.
Ironically, despite becoming a hotbed of Islamophobic acts, Denmark boasts the largest Shia Muslim mosque in Europe. Local worshippers say despite the hatred shown by some individuals, many other Danes are learning more about Islam, with Imam Hussein's story central to their understanding of Islamic teachings and values. Robert Carter, Copenhagen.
Malta. multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the grain deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, an opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. Sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang.
The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mojahedin-e-Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be dispatched from the country's southwest. The MEK had joined the Iraqi operations since the early years of the war, but this time it wanted its own members to perform the operation. The Iraqi regime had provided 7,500 members of the terror cult with modern weapons and military equipment. The new strategy aimed to win the support of the Iranian people and establish an MEK-run puppet regime in Tehran, but to no avail. Iranian people regard the MEK members as invasive aggressors, so they responded to them by live fire. It was a surprise attack, as it occurred just days after Tehran and Baghdad accepted a UN resolution that ended the war and the front line was relatively calm. However, Saddam's ill intentions were met by fierce resistance from the Iranian people and armed forces. Iran's military launched a counterattack codenamed Operation Mersad and foiled the MEK operation just within 3 days by inflicting nearly 5,000 casualties on the terrorist group's members. Operation Mersad is of the essence in the region's history, as it is the last battle during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. It dashed Saddam's hopes of defeating Iran and thwarted the MEK's sinister ambitions. The MEK, now based in Albania, has carried out numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in terrorist attacks over the past 4 decades, about 12,000 have fallen victim to the MEK's acts of terror. The European Union, Canada, the United States, and Japan had previously listed the MEK as a terrorist organization. In 2012, the group was taken off the U.S. list of terrorist organizations. The EU followed suit, removing the group from its list of terrorist organizations. Washington and its allies even give the terrorist group all-out logistical and monetary support, hosting its meetings on their territories while speaking of human rights and world peace.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
With hundreds of fires raging, Toronto, New York, and Washington, D.C. have the world's unhealthiest air. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, Toronto and New York stood in first and second place on a list of the world's most polluted urban areas compiled by IQ Air recently. With wildfires burning in Canada, a choking smoke it has spread to major American metropolitan areas. More than 500 fires have been burning across several Canadian provinces for almost a month, spreading an orange-brown haze across eastern Canada and the U.S. Midwest and Northeast. The heavy concentration of particulate matter in the smoke has led public health officials to hand out masks and instruct people to remain indoors. More than 120 million Americans, a third of the population, were living under some kind of air quality alert, CNN reported. Toronto has recently had the worst air quality of any city in the world, according to a live index compiled by IQ Air, a Swiss air filter company. Toronto scored 154 on the company's index, making its air unhealthy for anyone to breathe. New York City and Washington, D.C. followed in second and third place with respective scores of 142 and 120. IQ Air considers an air quality of between 100 and 150 to be unhealthy for sensitive groups. Montreal, Chicago, and Detroit are also in the top 10 on IQ Air's list, alongside cities more commonly associated with air pollution, such as Beijing, Hanoi, and Calcutta. Earlier this week, Chicago and Detroit alternated between first and second place until prevailing winds pushed some of the smoke east. Residents of the Canadian province of Ontario and Ohio River Valley, which includes areas of New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Tennessee, have reported smelling burning plastic in the air. According to the Weather Network, this phenomenon occurs when smoke has lingered in the air for so long that the sun's radiation begins to break it down to release toxic benzene and formaldehyde. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has described the 2023 wildfire season as unprecedented and the worst since records began. While wildfire season usually peaks in mid-July, more emissions have already been released this year than any other year on record, according to a report published recently by Copernicus, the European Union's Earth Observation Program. Trudeau has blamed the fires on climate change, while his critics argue that poor forest management and a refusal by the authorities to engage in controlled burns are the true causes of the disastrous blazes. Also, Axios reported the smoke from unprecedented wildfires in Canada triggered poor air quality alerts over swathes of the U.S. again, with multiple cities reporting some of the worst air pollution levels of any major city around the world. While continuing to choke the Great Lakes region and the upper Midwest, the low-lying smoke also drifted southeast and began affecting Ohio Valley and mid-Atlantic cities. Canadian cities, too, were also greatly affected by the smoke, with the Toronto reporting the worst air quality for major cities around the world, according to Swiss air technology company IQ Air. Smoke from unprecedented Canadian wildfires, which have been exacerbated by human-caused climate change and global warming, has repeatedly choked North American cities this summer, and additional rounds of smoke may follow. Canada is experiencing its worst wildfire season on record, driven by extreme heat events and exacerbating drought conditions, according to data from the Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Centre, CIFFC. Because of their size, locations, and behavior, the fires are not expected to be extinguished anytime soon, either by firefighters or a major shift in weather conditions until after summer ends, Axios Andrew Friedman reports. Inhaling wildfire smoke when it's present in high concentrations at ground level can cause serious health complications and is especially dangerous for elderly populations and people with heart ailments or asthma. An Air Quality Action Day was declared for all of Northeast Illinois and Northwest Indiana, meaning fine particulate matter and other pollutants could build to unhealthy levels in the outdoor air. Air quality alerts across Upper Midwest are expected to remain in effect, according to the National Weather Service. Chicago had the second worst air quality for major cities around the world, with a 181, or a code red, on the Air Quality Index, which is considered dangerous for sensitive groups. Detroit and Minneapolis followed with the second and third worst levels, respectively. Cleveland, which wasn't included in IQ Air's ranking system, had an AQI of 238, which is considered dangerous for all people. An Environmental Protection Agency monitor near Chippewa Lake, Ohio, was reporting an AQI of 309, which is a code maroon, the highest alert level of the index. The Cleveland skyline couldn't be seen from live cameras positioned just a few miles from a shore, while visibility at the city's international airport fell to 1.25 miles multiple times throughout the day. A slight haze and the smell of smoke were present in Washington, D.C., where air quality fell to levels unhealthy to sensitive groups of people. The smoke caused a thick haze in downtown Chicago, reducing visibility at Chicago O'Hare International Airport to 1.25 miles for several hours on several days. Winds have also carried the smoke across the Atlantic Ocean over to Europe, where the sun was partially shrouded in areas of Portugal and Spain. 476 wildfires were burning across Canada, including 234 out-of-control fires. CIFFC reported that 2,957 fires this season have burnt 19.3 million acres, 7.8 million hectares in Canada, which is an area equivalent to all of Michigan's forest land. The reported total number of fires jumped to 2,988, while the burnt acreage went up to around 19.8 million acres, 8 million hectares.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, there has been a wave of Quran burnings in northern Europe recently. Islamophobic acts are not new. Since 9/11, Muslims and their values have been increasingly under attack. With the creation of Daesh, Western Hegemonic Front wanted to use the terrorist group to misrepresent Islam and at the same time kill and torture Muslims and destroy Islamic lands. Since that project failed, like so many others, another form of attack and incitement has been initiated against Muslims. Countries like Sweden and Denmark, where these attacks have occurred, are saying there is nothing that they can do to stop the attacks because of freedom in that country. We're going to take a look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Zafar Bangash, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, out of Toronto. And Firas Al-Najem, human rights activist, also out of Toronto. Thank you both for being with us. Well, Zafar, I'd like to start it off with you. Why do you think that we're seeing a sudden increase in these attacks?
Well, basically, there are several reasons for it. First of all, there is, of course, this very long tradition of the West's animosity towards Islam and Muslims. They always want to denigrate Islamic sacred symbols as well as personalities because they see Islam as a challenge to their hedonistic culture. And there is a very long history of this. The other aspect, of course, in recent years has been the fact that a large number of Muslim refugees have arrived in these countries, primarily because of the wars that the West has imposed upon Muslim countries. They go and destroy these Muslim countries, but they don't want the refugees fleeing those wars that the West has imposed upon those countries. And so there is a backlash, especially among right-wing politicians who want to cash in on this. Muslims are an easy target. And so this is what we are witnessing in countries like Sweden, Denmark, even Austria, France, Germany, Britain, you name it. In fact, the whole of the European Union is involved in this anti-Muslim and anti-Islam attacks and propaganda. And they see the burning of the Quran as a way of inciting Muslims, insulting Muslims, and basically conveying the message that they don't want Muslims in their midst. Or if the Muslims want to live there, then they have to abandon their religion, their belief system, and their way of life, which is contrary to the hedonistic, vulgar culture that is prevalent, unfortunately, in most Muslim societies.
Well, Firas, how likely are these simply individual random attacks? So do you think that there's a more coordinated effort behind these insults? There have been accusations that Western intelligence agencies, along with their Zionist cohorts, are behind these type of incitements. Your thoughts?
Yes. I mean, we know historically and, in media that the Zionists, the pro-Israelis, have worked to craft a way to label Muslims as terrorists. That's why they always use the word, for instance, Islamist terrorist all the time in media, and also to justify their occupation and the killing of Palestinians and theft of their land and occupying their land. So they have crafted a way where they can make Muslims look like they're bad and their holy book is bad. And it's kind of portrayed an image and kind of embedded an image in people that Muslims are a threat and their book is a threat. And this has also spread hate towards the Muslims for many years, right? That's why they were able to justify wars, as Brother Zafar Bangash was saying. The West was behind all these wars, and they justified it by saying they're fighting for human rights, fighting tyranny, fighting terrorists, whatever it is that they use as a label and excuse. At the end of the day, they're going to Muslim countries and they're killing Muslims as well, right? And this is all affiliated with media. The media is portraying a certain picture and painting a certain picture about Muslims. And now some of these people that have arrogance and ignorance possibly towards Islam, they're committing these crimes. And at the same time, also, the Israelis could be behind it. I mean, I did hear a statement from the Islamic Republic of Iran saying that the Mossad or the Israelis were somehow affiliated and supporting this guy's Salwan that burned the Quran, essentially, the first time. But, you know, they've seen that the Muslim reaction has been very peaceful, but very painful. It was very painful for the Muslims. But at the end of the day, the Muslims, how much tolerance can they have when you disrespect what they stand for and what they believe in and what they're willing to die for? We've seen what happened to Salman Rushdie, and he disrespected the Quran. We don't want to see more attacks on the Muslims, and we don't want to see a retaliation at the same time, you know, because they'll also use that in media against the Muslims, saying that, oh, look at Muslims, when somebody attacks their religion, they're going to go do something violent.
Well, Zafar, as the sacrilegious acts have increased, Muslims have shown growing outrage. Now, there are those who say, critics who say, that Muslims in reality should simply ignore what is happening and this will stop. But what would you say to that?
You see, the thing is that Muslims cannot ignore these acts because they offend the sentiments of the Muslims very deeply. In fact, if Muslims were to remain silent and say do nothing, then that would be basically accepting the Western agenda. I think a more responsible way to respond to these kinds of vicious insults and attacks would be for Muslim individuals as well as Muslim countries to launch a boycott of these regimes in Europe, whether it is Sweden, Denmark, France, or any of these other regimes, because they are primarily dependent on exports. And if Muslims were to launch a boycott campaign, especially Muslim governments, I think it would send the right message to these countries that these kinds of insulting behavior would not be tolerated.
Okay, we want to get to that. I want to get to that actually at the end of the program of what we need to do and the best response. But Firas, in your perspective, which entity benefit the most from this type of incitement?
I mean, obviously the Zionist regime, right? Because they want to see the Muslim world, in battles with different countries, and distorted and divided in the battle, the divine battle that is the main battle, is obviously to liberate Palestine, because that place is occupied by the Zionists. And they're the ones that are always desecrating and disrespecting the holy sites over there. In the holy month of Ramadan, they go inside the mosque with their boots, you know, the IDF. They step on the Qurans, they step on the people's rights. I mean, so this is the door for people to be immune and accept all this disrespect and all these attacks against Muslims. So once you put a stop to that and then liberate that land and fight this entity that is the main Islamophobic entity, you can say, they're the ones that are spreading Islamophobia and trying to get people to hate Islam and portray Islam as a bad religion, when Islam is a peaceful religion and a religion that promotes love and diversity. You know, I can give you one example of that. Here in Canada, a boy called Yusuf al-Hasnawi that passed away, he was celebrating the Prophet Muhammad's birth anniversary, and he was in a mosque called Al-Mustafa, and he was reciting the Holy Quran, and once he stepped out of the mosque, he's seen a person outside, a white person, not even a Muslim, that was being attacked, was being robbed. And he intervened to save this guy's life, and he was shot in the process. And then after that, when the paramedics came, they disregarded the severity of the case, and they played it off and laughed it off. Thankfully, the paramedics were charged criminally and then convicted. It was the first time that paramedics were ever convicted in the history of Canada. Okay, and this man, they called him a good Samaritan. The detective that was on the case called Yusuf al-Hasnawi a good Samaritan. So this boy just read Quran, and he came outside, and he went to save somebody, and he was not supported by the whole system in Canada, in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. I mean, there's so many other cases as well. The Quran teaches us to help people, to support people. to stand for our belief, and our belief is a belief of righteousness, of ethics, of principles that are amazing. But people just need to study that and learn that more, not from mainstream media, from other sources, credible sources. You know, look at the Islamic Republic of Iran, supporting not just Muslims, they're supporting other countries that are sanctioned, such as Venezuela, other nations that are being suffering everywhere in the world. They're willing to extend their hand to support them. So this is the real Islam, right? But they have created a bad image of Islam, and now we're seeing these attacks as well. And it's all serving pretty much the evil entities and the colonial powers and their plans. And that is obviously the Saudi regime and Israel and all these different entities that they have planted in the Middle East and different places in the world. At the end of the day, we want to see peace. We want to see respect to all religions and all holy books. It's not just the Muslim book. We don't accept seeing the Bible being burnt or the Torah or any other holy book. We do not accept that, and we would stand to defend that. You know, it's not just about Islam. It's about anything that's holy and means something to people's hearts. We should respect it, and we should safeguard it. Okay. And that is a clear hate crime, and hate crimes should be prosecuted.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Zafa, the Organization of Islamic Countries is having a virtual meeting to try to have a coordinated response from the Muslim world in dealing with this. First of all, I want your perspective about this move, and do you think that they can come up with something effective action? And secondly, how likely are these type of acts actually likely to bring the Muslim countries even closer together, being on the same page?
Well, you see, as far as the Organization of Islamic Cooperation is concerned, it is essential that it should spearhead this campaign and come up with very practical solutions. So, for instance, earlier this month, beginning of July, when there was this incident of desecration of the Quran in Sweden, at least two Muslim countries took steps to take diplomatic action against Sweden, Iraq and the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, there are 57 Muslim countries in the world. I think if all 57 Muslim countries in the world were to expel Swedish ambassadors from their countries and withdraw their ambassadors from Sweden, I think it would send a very powerful signal to the government in Sweden that their conduct, regardless of what excuses they advance, I mean, they say that, you know, there is absolute freedom of speech in Sweden, which is not true. Nobody in Sweden would dare to question the Holocaust, for instance. I'm not suggesting that anybody should. What I'm saying is that there are limits to freedom of speech. But why is it that there is no limit on hateful speech against Muslims or Muslims' sacred texts or Muslims' revered personalities? So that's the first thing. Secondly, we shouldn't accept the West's definition of freedom of speech, because again, it is not absolute. There are limits. And when it begins to impact their interests, then they are prepared to take steps and listen. So, for instance, we have heard from Swedish as well as Danish politicians or government officials that they want to look into these various steps that would prevent desecration of the Noble Quran. But I'm afraid I do not hold much hope that anything positive is going to come out of that, because these politicians in Sweden and Denmark, etc., see that regrettably Muslims are not united, that Muslim countries do not speak with one voice. They are divided among themselves. They pursue their own narrow interests, and they ignore the larger interests of the Muslim Ummah, the sentiment of the Muslim Ummah. And so in that sense, much more effort is needed in terms of Muslim governments acting collectively. Mm-hmm. If they do, they have an enormous clout. They can effect change, but it requires will, it requires commitment, and it requires dedication and persistency. And that is something that needs to be worked on in order to convey a proper, strong message to these violators and offenders of Muslim sentiments.
Well, Feroz, just as Zafar had said, there are some officials in both Sweden and Denmark saying that they're interested in changing the law to limit holy books from being disrespected. But incitement of violence and religious hatred are already prohibited in both Denmark and Sweden. So why wouldn't these acts already be prohibited then?
I mean, because they're biased, right? They're biased towards the Muslims, as we've seen the way they treat the Muslims, the refugees, the way they treat the Muslim nations, you know, the support they give, for causing internal, divisions between Muslims, such as supporting the Saudi regime. So much of these Western governments were supporting the Saudi regime and killing the Yemeni people, for instance, to see Muslims and Muslims killed, to support the Zionist regime. How much of these Western regimes have supported the Israeli regime, knowing that they disrespect Muslims all day and night and desecrate the mosque and so on. So this is a normal practice for them. I guess they're biased. You can see that how they support the Ukrainian resistance, but they don't support the Palestinian resistance, right? Where is the equality on that part? But, I mean, we have some strong statements from Islamic leaders, such as Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. His statement is very important. He said, if Islamic countries fail to act in defense of the Quran, then Muslim youth must act in accordance with their responsibility and punish the desecrators and await no one to defend their religion. I think that the West should take this statement very serious, because Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a well-popular person inside the Islamic world, and he has done a lot to support and defend Islam, especially in Lebanon, how he kicked out the Israelis and the invaders and the occupiers, the Israelis at the time, and he supports the Palestinians on a very high level and supports Muslims in a high level. They should take good measures to support the Muslims and support the law as well, their law and their country, that it should not be able to be violated. And it is being violated. By burning the Quran, they're actually violating the laws in these Western countries, but they're just keeping a blind eye on it for certain purposes, and the purposes are not good purposes at all.
Well, Zafar, you talked about the number of Muslim countries that we have in the world. Let's talk about coordinated action. What can be done? And the economic consequences that actually these Muslim countries could actually create for these countries that are allowing this type of desecration?
If we look at these countries that are indulging in this kind of behavior, which is extremely offensive to Muslims and to their sacred scriptures, as well as revered personalities, then there are several steps that Muslims can take. And there is a precedent for us. For instance, in 2005, when the Danish cartoons about the Prophet of Islam first appeared, obviously Muslims were very upset. And there were not only demonstrations, but Muslims launched a boycott campaign. And let me tell you, Denmark's total exports are about $234 billion. And most of its exports, for instance, its dairy products, the Muslims boycotted them. Arla is one of the major dairy producing companies in Denmark. And within 6 months, this company's sales had dropped by $60 million. And this was because Muslims had, in the Muslim world itself, had launched a boycott campaign. And the magazine, Jailan's Posten, that had published these cartoons, it had to take out full-page advertisements in newspapers throughout the Muslim countries, particularly in West Asia, apologizing that they published these cartoons, saying that they did not mean to offend the Muslims and that they would not do such a thing again. Now, let's look at Sweden. There are many Swedish products that are sold all over the world. For instance, Ericsson, Volvo cars, as well as IKEA furniture. IKEA, for instance, employs something like 350,000 people in its stores worldwide. Volvo, last year it sold something like 650,000 vehicles worldwide. You know, these are things that Muslims need to pay attention to. If Muslim governments were to basically launch a boycott of these products, they don't have to do anything else. They just say, okay, we are not going to buy Volvo cars or Volvo trucks. We are not going to buy IKEA furniture. We are not going to use Ericsson, electronic products. The world would not come to an end as far as the Muslims are concerned because there are alternatives available. But it requires a little bit of imagination, and it requires a little bit of sincerity from these Muslim countries to be able to stand up for their values and their principles. And that can have a very, very sobering effect on these regimes, because appealing to them in terms of saying, don't offend our sentiments, etc., they are not going to pay attention. But when you hit their pocketbook, they will pay attention.
Well, Firas, 30 seconds. What is it going to take to fight Islamophobia in general?
A unity of Muslims and Muslim nations and governments, and at the same time, strong action, I think, by the Muslims to defend Islam and to defend at the time when these type of acts happen, when these treacherous, hideous acts happen against the Muslims. If some of the Muslims, take some concrete and bold, strong action to defend their religion and to stand against this injustice, I think this will help a lot.
Thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Zafar Bangash,